stole off the internet many years ago. I don't know if it's still available, but it's actually very fast, and you can see that for your homework you'll be doing systems that are that would just be a little corner up here, sort of 10 by 10, 20 by 20. I think I'm asking also for a 50 by 50. This here is running live on the screen, and you can see there's a speed toggle, so I actually had to turn down the speed of the simulation a little bit, because otherwise it would be just flickering, because it runs too fast. So what you see here, there are sort of two panels. The upper one here, it should just be the easing configurations that you're looking at. In this case, for 458 by 270 lattice. The bottom panel here display the changes, and you can sort of forget about that. So the one you should be focusing on is the upper one here. And it's just displaying the position of the easing spins as a function of the Monte Carlo sweeps that we're doing. Now you can see over here is a thermometer, right? And there is a point on this thermometer here where it says TC. And you can actually see there is, it's converted into a beta. So up on the top panel, there's something that'll be that's called beta. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do a quench. So let's go down to a temperature which is way below the critical temperature. And then you should see something that is the statistical mechanical version of a lava lamp. Because we can now, it's very amusing to sit and watch this. I was running it way up here, where roughly half the spins were pointing up and half the spins were pointing down. Now I quenched way below, and what's going to be happening is that the two faces, all spins up and all spins down, they're going to battle it out. And eventually we're going to see that one of them will win out over the other one. It might actually take quite some time, and in this case it may take more time than this lecture. But this is a real phenomenon. If you do this quench, then these things will happen. You can see now the black domain here. This is done with periodic boundary conditions, so it wraps around. And we have two domains here that are roughly of the same size, and they're trying to eat each other. Well, we can sit and wait and see what happens. You can also see that there's some black dots here that occurs in the white domain, and that's single spin flip. So this is running with a single spin flip algorithm, and just as you would be doing for the homework. And you can see that in this white face here, there are some spins that get turned, but immediately they get reversed. And if I go down to an even lower temperature, then you know, they should occur less and less frequently, and indeed, I think that's what you see. So this is quite instructive. But let me do something else. Let's now heat this up again. So if I go up to a very high temperature, then we're melting, and quickly here, you can see that it's. Everything just starts to look gray. So this is quite a bit above the critical temperature, and now I'm going to go straight to the critical temperature. And what you'll see is actually something that you have to stare at it for a while. You can see that compared to the high temperature, where we just had something that was all gray, right at this temperature, I was going to say I wanted my cappuccino with cream, but anyway, what I was going to say here is that this looks different from the high temperature simulation, and it looks different if you sit and stare at it. It looks much better in my screen. I don't know why this is so bad, but what you should see here is that there should sort of be blobs on every size on every length scale. So if we concentrate on the black blobs here, then there should be very small ones, larger one, and actually all the way up to the size of the system. And you can see maybe I have a big one that's going through here. And that's, of course, a signal that we're running at TC and the correlation length has diverged. So you should contrast. So I always like to say that I like to think about the correlation length as actually a size of a typical fluctuation that occurs. So if we heat it up again, then you can see as soon as I go above TC, then this phenomenon disappears. Suddenly now the big domains wash out, and we get a typical size of the fluctuation that is maybe large, but definitely finite. And if I go way up in temperature, then you can see that how do people lecture with this screen? Do they stand behind it? I don't know. This is, and then scream and back projection. I could do animals behind the screen. I don't know. You can see this is quite different, right? Anyway, so there's actually a lot of simulation or a lot of physics that you can get out from just staring at this one. So let's just do the lava lamp again just to see if we can, with a little bit of luck, you can do it. Wow. Now we have background music. Okay, so you can, now I would claim that there's going to be a big blob and that will probably die. See, if they don't connect here, then this one will die. You can see it's getting smaller. No, I think it's written in C, but it hardly matters. The reason that it's so fast is that the video is done straight in X11, so it just hooks into the very basic video. You can also not die there. Once it gets small, and then boof, it's gone. If you go on the internet, you can find this in Java, and try running a Java like this for a 500 by 300 lattice, it'll not run. Of course, I should bump this up in full speed. So that's what it looks like in full speed. You can anyway. So while we're at it, I just also, so this was I think the last tutorial from that we did last year, and I guess you can't really read it, but as you'll see when you do a Monte Carlo simulation, you will be measuring things like the energy, maybe the magnetization and so forth, and then you would be calculating error bars on these things. And after a while, then you, of course, realize that you're just repeating the same code over and over again. So you can actually write a little class, and that's what we did for the last tutorial, where we just define something like this. It would be a Monte Carlo variable, where you would be storing the average and the sum of the squares of the variables. And once I have access to this, then I can write another little routine here, which is called error bar, or it's actually called the error on the average, that for all the variables I can I have declared, I can just have it dump out the current estimate of the error bar. And you can see if you read a little bit more about Fortran, then I actually went in and defined this as generic functions here. So I can call the error bars on variables that are defined either in terms of integers or in double precisions and whatnot. And then you just get all your error bars automatically. So if you're interested in over lunch, I can show you that code in more detail. And then I should try to get out of this. Okay. So at this point, do you feel comfortable doing the last homework on the Monte Carlo simulation? Are there conceptual issues? Those of you who've done Monte Carlo before, then this is it's about the most classical one. I have sort of a little list of things here that I want to run through, just because I know that in some cases confusion arises when we talk about this. So the first thing here is about the boundary conditions. And in the for the homework, we I'm asking that you use periodic boundary conditions. And so what this means is that when we sum over the lattice here, then we're actually assuming that it's on a torus. So S L plus 1 here, comma J, is actually identified with S1 of J. And we all know this, so it's not a big not a big problem. The question is, how do we implement this efficiently? And so what I could do is that I could put in a lot of if statements. And suppose that you want to write a code, a little code, and we're asking for this, that you can evaluate the energy from this double sum here. And then you can see if you make a loop that will run over I and another one that will run over J, then you actually have to say, well, does I happen to be equal to L? And so forth. So there's nothing wrong with that, except for in my humble opinion, you're more error prone if you do this. So I have one suggestion for how to do it that is, I think we put into the homework assignment, and that's just to use index arrays. And what I mean by this is that suppose that I define an integer array here of dimension L comma L, and we call that S. So that's where all my icing spins are sitting. And then of course you could say that well, if they're all just 1 and minus 1, it's sort of a waste to use a 32-bit integer to do that, but hey, we can afford that today. So what I mean here by these index array is that suppose I want to access an element and let's call it I plus 1 and J. So that would be one of the neighbors. Instead of actually writing I plus 1 or doing some the equivalent of doing a mod statement or doing an if statement here, is I could do some modulus. I could actually calculate I minus 1 modulus L and then add 1 to it and so forth. I'm just suggesting that instead of doing this, you define a little array here that's called NP of J. And then similarly, if you want to access the other neighbor, that would be N minus of I. And of course, if I want to get the neighbor in the other direction in J, then I can do the same thing here. And then all you have to do is that I have to define NP of 1 to be equal to 2, NP of 2 to be equal to 3, and then NP of L here, that would be equal to 1. Right? In other words, I'm accessing the elements in the spin configuration through an index array. And similarly, I can just look at the neighbor in the other direction. So let's call that NM of 1. I set that equal to L, and then MM of 2 here, I set that equal to 1, and so forth. And then MN of L here, that's of course equal to L minus 1. So when I want to look at the four neighbors to a spin here, I and J, then the neighbors, of course, would be I minus 1, J, and then I plus 1, J, I and J plus 1, I and J minus 1. Then I just look up these neighbors, and I do them through these index arrays. And then all I have to do is that I just have to do these index arrays correctly at the beginning of the program. And I would claim that getting this wrong here is more difficult than getting a lot of if statements wrong or some modulus operations wrong. So that was my suggestions. If you don't like that, then it's a free country. But I have a preference for trying to eliminate errors as much as we can. There's another added little wrinkle that once you see the idea of using these index arrays, then you could think, well, hey, we actually did operations on matrices and solving linear equations where I said, well, maybe we should interchange the rows and columns of the matrices. And I don't know any serious implementation of that that would not use index arrays. Nobody would actually take a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix and then actually try to interchange the rows and columns in it. What you do is, of course, that you always address it through this a column array and a row array, and then you just interchange elements in the index array. And that has the same effect, and you're not actually physically moving anything in the memory, and you're done with it. It looks a little bit less transparent, but it's very easy to work with. Okay, so Erebus, you're all... That was just my explanation. So sometimes students ask me, what do I mean by doing this? And that's what I mean, and it's a very simple idea. Okay, I just wanted to say something a little bit more here about the Erebus. Well, I'm just, when you want to calculate something like the energy here, this is the sum over the neighbors. So I have to look at the interaction with a spin and then it's four neighbors. And that would mean that I have to access S of I, J plus 1, S of I, J minus 1, and this one, and, you know, the other two. And in doing that, then you realize, oh, I will have to take into account the periodic boundary conditions. And there are various ways of doing it. I could have sort of an if statement here. If I is equal to L, then the neighbor in this direction would be 1J, would be this one. And the same in the direction upwards and downwards. But that would mean that I would have a whole bunch of if statements in there. And or I could actually do modulus here. So you can get the same effect by, instead of doing I plus 1, then write it as I minus 1 mod L plus 1. And believe me, there are an infinite number of ways of getting that wrong. I can, from painful experience, I can attest to that. So what I'm suggesting here is that you just replace the code here for S, I plus 1, and J by this one. And that has exactly the same effect, because in P here, I precisely coded in these boundary conditions in it, so it correctly goes and look up the element that I desire, taking into account the boundary conditions. And once for all, then I just don't have to think about them anymore. Okay? Error bias. Suppose we... No, it goes from 1 to L. So that's the... if I write it like this, then the Fortran definition is that the first element is 1, which is just a convention. If you like, actually what I should do here, I should write it 1 colon L and then 1 colon L. It's always better not to be relying on some kind of standard. Okay? And then these are the... that's also another point that's very easy to... should you... it's one of the fundamental problems in computer science. Should we start counting with 0 or should we start counting in 1? And, well, let's not go there. I was gonna talk a little bit about these error bars, because suppose that we did... You did labs when you were undergraduates, right? And then you probably did measurements. So let's do some measurement 1, measurement 2, measurement 3, and then measurement 4. And each of these measurements of the same quantity, that takes you about 15 minutes. So this here is about 1 hour of work. And then it's Friday afternoon, and in your lab manual, it says you need 8 of those. But then you get the brilliant idea, why don't I just duplicate the measurements that I have here and cut out early and go have a beer, right? So I just replicate this one, so I say that my M5 here is equal to M1 here, M6 is equal to M2, M7 is equal to M3, and then M8 here is equal to M4. How would you see that, or how would the teacher notice that you had cheated? Well, if we look at the I would claim here that the sum from I equal 1 to 4 of MI, that's equal to M bar. Let's call it that, like that. If, in particularly if I divide by 4, right? But if I just take precisely the same measurements and duplicate them, right, then we can see that I get the exact same number here if I sum over 8 of them, right? Because I'm just doubling every measurement. So if you go and look at the, so I would claim that the average here and then the, also the, so let's look at your error bar here. I would then claim that your average for the square and the square of the average, they would not change. But of course, here now I suddenly get a number that's twice as big. So what would happen in this is that any relevant quantity that you would be looking at, like the average here, it would of course remain unchanged, but your error bar would go down by a factor of 2, or root 2, sorry. And then I hope we can agree that, of course, this here is a correlation of 1 between this set of measurements and that set of measurements. So these are highly correlated. So my point is that this here has an error bar, which is root 2 too small, because really I actually didn't do any additional work. I didn't add any new information at all. I just cheated. So why is this relevant? That's because when we look at the Monte Carlo process, then we have some Monte Carlo box here, which is a little program that you write, and it's spitting out a sequence of data. So maybe x of t here, and then x of t plus 1, x of t plus 2, and then let's go up here, x of t plus L to the D, and then X of T plus L to the D plus 1, and so forth, right? So these are again correlated. And that would mean here that a simple estimate like this one is actually going to be as we were probably talking about yesterday already, if you calculate something like this, then you can be pretty certain that the true error bars are always larger, or if you're working without cheating too much, then the best you can hope is an equality here. So there are two things here. We talked about yesterday that if my x and t and x and t plus 1 here differ in one attempted spin flip, then when I have attempted L to the D spin flips here, then that's what we define as one Monte Carlo sweep. And often this is written as MCS. Okay, so an important point that I always forget here, this here is an attempted spin flip. So if I look at x of t and x of t plus 1, these could actually be the same, because I could have decided in my Monte Carlo algorithm not to move right? We're going to have to accept the proposed change to the configuration with some probability, and we could decide, I don't want to do anything. And when you're designing some kind of Monte Carlo algorithm, it becomes extremely tempting at some point to say, well, if I'm not doing anything, what could it matter if I removed that configuration from the sequence? Don't do that, right? Because you're going to have to go back and remember that this is coming out of a stochastic process where we designed the transition probability precisely in the way so that the random walk that we're doing should give us the Boltzmann distribution. It's a very, very dangerous thing then to go in and then by saying, well, you know, how could it, if I remove not doing anything, how could that matter? But of course it does matter. So we have to keep these in the sequence here. So if we go back and look at these error bars, I could get the idea that I actually wanted to do something rigorous. So I could look at an autocorrelation. And if you've already done your easing simulation and everything is working brilliantly, then you can play around with this. So the easing or the autocorrelation here, I could, for instance, look at the energy at some time T0 and then correlate it with, actually, let's just write it quite generally. Let's just say that I look at my observable at T0 and then the same observable at a time T later. And what we would need, so what I mean by this average here, again, when we're doing Monte Carlo, all you have to do is that you just add up observation and then divide by the number of them. So I would take an observation here and then an observation T later, and then I would just add all these observations up as many times as I can, and then divide by the number of these observations. And that's what I mean by this one. If I let T here go to infinity, what does that approach? Why would it?
Yes.
So this here, if I let T go to infinity, this approaches x of T0 here, and then x of T0 plus T on the basis that we're assuming that I'm looking at the average of two independent variables. So actually, maybe I should look at, if you like, the connected function. So I look at x of t0 here, and then x of t0 plus t. And then I subtract this term here, but you can see that this is just the average of x squared. So this one, as you're saying, that would probably start at something non-zero and then go to zero, right? But then we get a little bit clever because I look at this first term and then I say, what is the maximum value that it could have? Well, if we're thinking about this as a correlation function, then the highest correlation that we could sort of get, that would be if I set t equal to zero. So maybe I should actually divide this by the value of this function it has in t equal to zero, and that's of course nothing but the average of x squared. And so I should subtract this one. Now, that is a, so often when we look at a autocorrelation function, and let's give it a label of x here, we would use some definition like this, but lastly, this term and whatever we divide with, it's just a matter of convention here because we would like something that behaves nicely. So I can look at this And if I divide it with this, then it would have to start out at 1. And I hope that I can convince you here that this quantity here is then going to decrease monatomically from 1 to 0. So it's just going to go down like this. And it'll do this as a function of some time here. And if I then go out and say that, well, if when these correlations here have decreased, so that I'm reaching value here, which is 1 over E, then I could go out there and say that this defies what I would call the autocorrelation time. And it's very amusing to do this little exercise. You can see it's just another quantity that we'd be calculating. So if you go ahead and do that, let me just give you two hints here. For small lattices, then the autocorrelation time here is relatively small. That's one reason why we didn't ask you to do a simulation on a lattice that was 1,000 by 1,000. So in that case, you may actually look at a T here, which is measured in single flips. And however, there's lots known about this, which is quite interesting. So if we set the temperature that we're running at equal to TC, then this autocorrelation time here, it of course depends on the size of the lattice that I'm looking at. And it does so with an exponent which is akin or similar to a dynamical critical exponent. Often it's denoted by set Monte Carlo. And the sort of mean field ballpark estimate is that is around sort of 2.2, or for practical purposes, if you want to ballpark something, then you say it's L squared. Right? So we look at the correlations of our functions here, and then we, for a 10 by 10 lattice, we make sure that I'm measuring things, so I'm not influenced here by the autocorrelation time. And then you run the simulation where you do 100 by 100 lattice. That would mean, if we just look at these ballpark estimates here, it would mean that the autocorrelation time would have gone up by a factor of 100. And this is often where people get into trouble, because they check that they're doing their Monte Carlo calculations correctly for small lattices where they don't have any problem, and then they run the stuff that is sent to PRL on a humongous lattice and then say, well, you know, I don't have a problem with the autocorrelation time, but of course the autocorrelation time went up by an enormous factor. And if you think about it, the dynamical process, it just means that the space that you're walking around in when you increase the size of the lattice, of course, becomes enormously larger. And if you're doing something as simple as this single spin flip algorithm, then you're just walking so slowly that the increment or the exponential increase in the total state space is going to kill you, right? You'll just get lost in the wilderness. This phenomenon here is sometimes called critical slowing down. Precisely for this purpose, people invented these cluster algorithms. And it's today. Oh, so by the way, the little simulation that I showed you, I can actually switch it over so we run one of these cluster algorithms. Maybe I'll do that at the end today. Okay. But back to this point here with the autocorrelation time. If we now look at our error bars here, then you can say that we should choose what's called n step here in units of Monte Carlo sweeps bigger than the autocorrelation time, right? Or rather, it's not only that we must, right? So n step, if you haven't read the homework number 3, it is just the how many Monte Carlo sweeps I would perform between taking a measurement of an observable and using that for an estimate of my thermodynamic average. So if this here would be one Monte Carlo sweep, then maybe way down over here, I would actually have an x to the t plus n step ld here. And that would then be my new measurement of the energy, right? So you make, and when you do this, there's no point in thinking of these time scales here, except for maybe if you're doing this calculation, in terms of single spin flips. We're always assuming that all we're doing involves entire Monte Carlo sweeps of the lattice. Okay, so I hope you can see that if we have a phenomenon like this where there's an autocorrelation time that is finite and it could get quite large, then we need to, in order for this error estimates and so forth to make sense, we need to take measurements at a distance in time here, which is bigger than the autocorrelation time. So you can actually, if we call our measurement here, let's call that delta, I can actually do a little calculation here, because I can plot delta, and I can plot it as a function here of n step. And what you'll see is that your error bar will start out a fairly slow value, and then it'll actually suddenly increase and then attain another plateau. And of course, this is just another way of calculating or estimating the autocorrelation time, because we would say that probably tau is around there. So when people do this exercise or this simulation on the Ising model, it's a very important thing that you need to figure out what you should choose here for n step, and for also n warm up, which is the other parameter that you need to stick into your simulation. So n warm up is how many Monte Carlo sweeps you would be using before you start doing anything. And students always ask me, why can't I just tell them that they have to do this and they should do this many measurements? And well, I always resist doing that, because I can't. These numbers here will depend quite a bit on the model that you're working with, the size of the lattice and the temperature. And it's very dangerous to say that you can choose them universally and then be safe and everything will work. But what you can say here is that we should always try to make sure that these are bigger than some autocorrelation time in the system. There's a little thing that I wanted to point out. You can see here that I start talking about this temporal axis. And we saw initially the Axel Monte Carlo algorithm running. And if you were able to look at how spins were flipping under thermal fluctuations, you could imagine that this would be quite close to what we observed here. But this here is, in reality, some kind of artificial time. And if we want to be totally honest, if I have some dynamical exponent that I want to put in here, it's coming from the dynamics I put into the system. So in classical statistical mechanics, as we're looking at here, then the dynamics are not defined in terms of the Ising model. If you just look at the interaction, there's no definition of how the spin should be flipping. It's something that we add in order to do the simulation. So I should point out that these estimates here, they of course depend on what we would call the Monte Carlo dynamics. And hence, if you instead of doing a simple spin flip, you do something clever, then you can probably get a Monte Carlo dynamical exponent, which would be quite different from this one. Okay. Are you happy with this? The other things that I just want to say one word about, and that's the units. If you look at it, then we would say that the units here of the coupling constant is some kind of energy. And hence, if I look at the units here of J over the Boltzmann constant K here, let's put a B on it, right? Then that should be in the units of some kind of temperature. And you might say that given the model that you've defined here, then we've actually defined some natural units for the temperature, which is just our coupling constant over KB, right? And so really, when we measure the temperature here, I can define dimensionless temperature, which is just T here over this natural unit here, and that's of course nothing but KT over J. You could get the idea that maybe you should pull out your physics book and figure out what Boltzmann's constant is. Maybe you should look at some material and figure out what a good value for J should be, and then actually stick in hard numbers for what these things should be. And that would give you not some kind of dimensional temperature, but a real temperature, which would be in Celsius or Kelvin, depending on how you would set things up. That's not what we do here, because a typical Monte Carlo simulation would rely on universality, because when we plot things as a function of the temperature here, then we would actually plot them as a function of KT over J here, because in the simulation we decide to work with this dimensionless temperature. In other words, when I plot a temperature axis, really what I'm doing is plotting KT over J here. And then maybe I get a curve like this. If you now come up with another material which would have a different J here, then my claim is that if universality indeed works, then the only thing that would actually do is that it would change the natural temperature scale that you would be working with, and hence change the numerical value for TC. But still, if I were to plot KT over J as my temperature axis, then data for different materials should follow a curve here that would be given by your Monte Carlo simulation for the Ising model, if indeed the materials that you're looking at is in what we would call the universality class defined by this model. Okay? So, this, in effect here, amounts to just setting k equal to 1 and j equal to 1. But I personally much prefer to say that really what we're doing here is that we're working with a dimensionless temperature, and hence when we're plotting data, then I should really say that what I'm plotting is not just the temperature, but temperature divided by this natural temperature scale, hence kT over j. And this becomes very confusing because if you look in the literature, then a lot of people are not very careful about this, and then they write some T here, and you don't know, well, what have they actually done, what have they set the units to, then there, of course, the people who are really famous, and when they publish, they don't even have to put axis labels on their figures, which is something that's even more annoying. Hopefully you won't do that, right? So you see, there's nothing really deep here, but you get my point that there's some natural scales that are set by the coupling constant J, and we can sort of pull them out. Man, it looks like it's Friday afternoon.
I should take photographs or something like
that. Post them on the internet. Okay, so I want to say one word about something that we don't have time to discuss, and I don't know if. I don't know all the courses, but if you get some field theory guy in here, then tell him just to prove that finite size scaling is correct. In your homework, the last homework, you will be working with a quantity here that's called G. From homework number 3. And very cleverly, it's designed so that it's a ratio of some moments, and that means that it's going to be dimensionless. You could say here is that, well, even though it's dimensionless, maybe it should depend on the reduced temperature, that is the distance to TC, and maybe also the size of the lattice. But the statement of finite size scaling is that really this here is just a single function that can only depend on L, and then divided by the correlation length in this manner, right? If I do this, then of course I get an argument here which is dimensionless, and that's the basic idea of finite size scaling, that instead of getting a lot of independent argument, then I get just a single argument like this. Now, if you remember critical phenomenon, then you know that as I'm approaching here the critical temperature, then this here should be diverging as the inverse of the reduced temperature. And that actually means that typically, instead of writing something like this, we actually write the argument here as T to the 1 over nu, and then times, T to the T here, and then L to the 1 over nu. Right? Now, if this here is dimensionless, then you can see that right at TC, then the argument is zero. So we would say that G here of, at TC here, G equals to a universal value here, G star. and actually independent of L. But as soon as I'm away from the critical, as soon as T here is different, then of course I will have a dependence on L. So this is a very neat little trick that if I can define some variable here, there's actually a reason for why it's defined like this that, well, we can talk about later. But this gives us a very good way of estimating where the critical point is. So if I do something like this, kT over j, then I can actually plot a curve like this for maybe L equal to 10. And if I then double the size here, then I get a curve for, so let's assume that this here is L equal to 20. These curves should cross at a point which is TC. And the statement here of universality is that when I look at this here, then it should actually be a universal function of this argument. So not only is the value that this function has a universal number at TC, and so this is my way of that number here where these things should cross is not just anything, and is known to three decimal places. I could then get clever and I say, well, if I believe that my function here I'm looking at is a universal function, then I shouldn't really here be plotting it versus kt minus j. I should actually take my x-axis and then plot it so I'm indeed plotting it versus t minus l to the power 1 over nu. In order to do that, you need some guess at TC, and of course the critical exponent nu. But then these largely different curves here, they should actually all line up, and I get some universal curve like this. So these are now for different L, but the fact that I transformed the x-axis means that everything lines up, and this is often called a scaling plot here, because I exploit some idea of how things would scale, i.e. this one, and that if that holds true, then it should indeed be possible to collapse all the data along a single line that I just, like I'm indicating here, and that would, it's sort of the first way or the simplest way that you could get some idea of what the critical exponent should be. Here we happen to know what TC is, and of course the critical exponent nu is also known. So you can sort of cross-check that this actually does hold true if you like. But in models where you don't know this, this is just sort of your first perhaps a crude estimate, but still a very workable estimate of what the critical temperature is and what the critical indices is. The theory of finite size scaling can actually be developed quite a bit further, and you can assume here that if I didn't have a dimensionless quantity, but I had something, a thermodynamic quantity, that I knew would be diverging at the critical point with some critical exponent, I can use the same analysis here to give scaling behavior of CV and psi. So the idea being that for a finite system, I cannot see a singularity. If I were to calculate the specific heat or the susceptibility, it cannot really be infinite because I'm doing this on a finite system. Hence, it has to be rounded in some way. And the end result is that I can generalize these arguments, and you would see a typical power law behavior in terms of L. So you would get a divergence which would be in the size of the system. And these, of course, worked out in many cases. And so that's another way of trying to estimate what the critical exponents would be. You can get that out from an extension of this finite size analysis. Questions at this point? I hope this didn't just bring in more confusion. Please tell me no. I would just like to spend, so we have a few minutes left here, and so I wanted to tell you this because it might sort of shed a bit more light on what you're actually doing. I wanted to use the last few minutes here to show you how you would do this on a quantum mechanical model. So which we could talk about for quite some time, but I just want to give you some idea of how it's working, because it actually looks very similar. So let's see if we can do this. So I want to look at how could I do something like quantum Monte Carlo. And what I'll tell you about now is what's sometimes called world line Monte Carlo. And the reason for that will become apparent later on. It's today there are a great many ways of doing this, and some of them are a lot more efficient, but I particularly like this one because it illustrates a number of it's sort of very intuitive, let's put it that way. And it was developed in the mid-80s and has been under the development ever since here. So the example here I want to look at is what you used when we did the Lanczos algorithm. So we look at a quantum spin chain. Now, the first point is that had I just taken the SZ component here, then of course it would just have been the Ising model, which you're doing for the homework, right? But now when I look at the full Heisenberg interaction between these two spins, I have things that are not commuting anymore. And that means that I have a real dynamic that is implied by the fact that these operators no longer commute. So for a typical quantum system, when I write down the Hamiltonian, then I've implicitly defined some kind of dynamics, and that'll show up at some point. So I'm going to write this so that it's a sum of two terms. And H1 here, that'll just be the sum from I equal 1 to n over 2 here. And then S2i is 2i plus 1. Okay? So you can see it's the interaction between neighboring spins, but not all of them. And then I have to take the last piece here, which is, of course, the interaction between 2i plus 1 and 2i plus 2. So you agree with me that I can write the Hamiltonian here as a sum of two terms that are given this way. Okay, so now what I want to do here, if you remember statistical mechanics, is that I need to evaluate the partition function. So actually, what I want to do here is I need to evaluate. I need really to evaluate the trace here of e to the beta h. If we go back and look at the Ising simulation that you're just doing, then h here would be a diagonal matrix, and then e to the minus beta h would be very simple to calculate because I can always calculate the exponential of a diagonal matrix. Here, this is not diagonal. So we do a little trick here. I say that this is actually a trace, but then I stick in something that's called the Trotter formula. Have you used the Trotter formula in some course? Or well, it's sort of a little bit of a cheat here. I can show that this here is the limit where m go to infinity, where I put in e to the minus beta h1, e to the minus beta h2, and then I divide here by m, and then I divide by m here, and then I take that whole thing to the power m. Okay. And then I need to take the limit where m goes to infinity. If you remember something about how you multiply exponentials of matrices together, then that's called the Baker-Hausdorff formula. And you might remember there's going to be some commutators in there. But it's possible to convince yourself that those terms, I can drop them or neglect them if I take m here to be large enough. If I look here at insight system, if I look at this here, which I would call set n, if I assume that I have 1, 2, n here, and of course I'm implicitly assuming periodic boundary conditions, then I would call this here now a partition function, again for n spins, but with a partition here for a finite m. Okay, so if we now look at this trace here, so if I look here at set n m, then well, it's going to be some gigantic sum here, and then over some states, and then I'm going to have to replicate a lot of these exponentials in there. So I would have some e to the minus beta over m h1, e to the minus beta over m h2, and then we repeat that again, minus beta m h1, e to the minus beta over m h2, and so forth. And they would be repeated. Of course, m times. So we get this here, m times. And then we get clever. because I'm going to insert some more states. So I'm going to insert complete states here at all these points. I'm going to insert them here, 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 and here. I'm going to insert some complete states. So instead of having a sum here over n here, then I actually get some big sum here that we can write as a sum over, well, let's call them nj and l here, and then a pi here over j, and then a pi from l equal 1 to 2 here, and then I have some psi nj l, and then a rho l here, and then a psi n j l plus 1. And this thing here, I'm going to call, so this one I'm going to call rho 2, and that one is called rho 1. Okay. So the way to think about this now is that I can look at this exponential, and probably when you first did your path integrals, you looked at a propagator u of t that would propagate us in real time, right? You didn't do that? Think that you did some courses on quantum field theory. Like the first time when you look at path integrals, there's a propagator that will propagate you. And you can see that here it sort of looks like this, right? I'm doing some propagation, but I'm doing it in imaginary time. So actually, what we do here in inserting these things is that I would start with my initial state here, and then I would propagate first with rho 1, because I wrote it like that, and then I would propagate with rho 2, and then I do that, and then I end up, of course, with the same state again. And that state here, so you can see that I end up, and in the end, when I've done this, then I'm wrapping around again, because I'm doing an actual physical trace here. So we can think about this process as being propagating in imaginary time. That's very instructive. So this looks like we've done something that's horribly complicated, but actually we haven't really. Because let's look now at what these terms here would do. Remember that H1, it only would couple between spin 2i and 2i plus 1. So I'm going to write this as a little box here. So let's maybe say that we start here with 0 and 1. And then the next term in H1 here would then connect 2 and 3. And I'm propagating with this. And that was actually one reason why I split the Hamiltonian in these two terms here. And then now the next propagator, rho 2 here, it will then just be propagating between 1 and 2, like this, and then between 3 and 4. Okay. So often, this here is called a checkerboard breakup. And then what you can see now is that what we're going to have to do is I'm going to have to do the sum now over all possible psi n, which would be all possible configurations of the spin at this level. But since I stuck in all these complete states, I also have to do the sum over all possible configurations here, there, and there, and there. So by the way, the imaginary time axis here would go from 0, and then in the end, I would propagate here m times. So the end time I get here is h beta, because, of course, in the many-body theory, then your real time axis is infinite, but your imaginary time axis is controlled by the inverse temperature, right? So if we do this at a finite temperature, then the imaginary time axis becomes finite. Now, you may not see this, but this is actually nothing more than a strange-looking Ising model. So there are sort of two things that, if I look at this thing that I've written here, you can see that the these matrices only would be working on these squares here. So actually, I have a sum here over all possible configurations, where I have a product of these things over what is sometimes called interacting or shaded squares. Okay, so this here was a 1D quantum model. And once I did this mumbo jumbo, you can see that I end up with something here, which is, for practical purposes, a D plus one dimensional classical model. Right, so there's a very interesting connection here. Quantum ends up, when we formulate it on a lattice, as being a D plus one dimensional classical model. Now, we have to look a little bit at these psi n here. So I'm going to choose them in the S set basis. And then we're actually going to have to figure out what happens when I apply rho 1 here to a given state here, which would just be, just think about what your Lanczos algorithm did. We had we also did a diagonalization of this exact Hamiltonian in the S-set basis, where the spins were pointing up, down, 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 up, and so forth. But you can see that the terms in H1 here will be independent, because the first term will act on spins 0 and 1, the next terms on 2 and 3. So I actually only have to, if I want to understand this problem, to look at how e to the minus beta S1 dot S2, and if you like, we should put a e to the minus beta over m here. And by the way, the beta over m here is often called delta tor. So we just have to figure out how that works. There's no way around it. I'm actually going to have to look at the interaction of two spins and then diagonalize the Hamiltonian. And you already know that if I do this and I just have two spins here, then I'm going to get a 4x4 matrix, and we can fight about what the numbers should be in there, and I'm sure you can all calculate them. So we would be going from up, 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 down, down, up, and then down, down, and the same thing over here, up, down, down, up, and then down, down. It turns out that for this isotropic interaction, I'm going to get something that is non-zero here. And then it'll be non-zero for these elements. and then I'm going to get something that's non-zero there. And the actual numbers here, it doesn't really matter. Of course, it does if you want to use this for calculation. But this becomes interesting because if we look at how we propagate in imaginary time, then we can see that, and I need color for doing this, we can see that this element here would correspond to starting with an upspin here and an upspin, and then after my propagation with the imaginary time propagator here, then I end up with up, up, okay? So that was my first interacting square here, and then I don't have any more chalk. And then the other ones here, and of course, equivalently, I would have one that would be down, down. But then these here, notably that one and that one, would do something else. I would have an up spin here, and it would cross over and then end up as an up spin after the propagation. But the down spin here, it would end up over on the other side. So they have actually been interchanged during the propagation. And of course, I'm going to have an equivalent one where they do exactly the opposite. So I would start with an up spin and then have it propagate over on the other side. And then I end here with a downspin and a downspin, and then I end up over here. So what you do is you take this classical correspondence very literally, and you say that the Monte Carlo thing you, or the Monte Carlo simulation that you have to do, is actually now a simulation over all possible values of tiling your bathroom floor. I don't know if anybody, I had a bathroom where the tiling was this checkerboard form here, so black and white. But there will be rules, because I cannot just take any tile here and replace it with another one, because the propagation in imaginary time here will imply some constraints on what can happen. And that's what gives rise to the a name world line Monte Carlo, because you can draw sort of world lines that would be connecting in imaginary time, where I would start here with a spin up, and then maybe at this point it would go over here, and then here it would just continue straight forward. And up here, it would go there. And then maybe here, it would go there. And then it would go forward and forward. And then maybe up here, it's going to go back again. Right? So this here, that would be what you would call a world line. Okay? And so what we have done is that if I take the extreme of this, where I'm assuming that these slices that I'm putting in imaginary time, if I take that, that's actually mathematically possible. I can reformulate this Monte Carlo method, and that was done by people in the early 2000s. I can take the continuum time or time step limit of it, and you get some complicated stochastic model. But what you can see here is that I get a path integral over trajectories here in imaginary time that'll wind around each other. And the way that they're winding around each other will reflect how quantum mechanics is implemented in this model. So if you sit and stare a little bit at this, then the way that the rules, or the way that the spins can wind once I'm applying the interaction of either row one and row two, it would implies, as I mentioned, certain rules for how I can put down the tiles here. And that would mean that if I want to update this, I cannot simply take a single one of these interacting squares and replace it by something else. If we think about this as a two-dimensional classical model, I could have gotten the idea of saying, why am I not simply sampling all my basis state in S set by going in and saying, well, here I'm assuming that this spin is up. Why don't I try to flip it down? Well, that's not going to work, because then you would have a world line that would start here and then annihilate. And that's not physically allowed. So I cannot flip a single spin. Then I say, well, why can't I just take one of these interacting squares and put another one in, and which would be sort of in your Monte Carlo on the classical easing model, it would be equivalent to flipping four spins. That's not going to work either. So in the end, what you realize is that around a what's sometimes called a non-interacting square, you have to take four of these non-interacting squares and then replace them by new ones. And when you do that, then you can that would be the equivalent of the single spin flip that you do in the Monte Carlo algorithm. So there's lots more than can be said about this. I'm just going to stop here. I just wanted to show you that these Monte Carlo algorithms can be taken very far. And for quantum models, then there's a very clear connection to actually evaluating path integrals over some abstract configurations here. And there's actually quite a bit of physics that can be gleaned from this. Yes?
Question. Are we putting all the spins in that shape?
Well, what I think about your bathroom floor, what you would need to do is that you would have to pull out all the tiles here. So in this case, these four interacting tiles, and then replace them with something else that would fit into the existing configuration. So if we imagine here that I had a spin that currently was going up like this, and then another spin that was pointing down all the way here, and then we don't really need to know what was going on here and there, then it has to fit into the existing tiling. So I can't really change what happens there, 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 and there. So the only thing I could do in this setting is that I could have it go up like this, like that, and like that. And then the other one would be going like this, and like that, and like that, right? That would still, I would mean that I could take this whole chunk of the lattice, and at the endpoints, then I guess this is pointing down, this is pointing down, this one is pointing up. Sorry, I'll probably interchange my coloring for up and down spin here, but it doesn't matter. You can see this chunk of the lattice that I have here, I can replace it with that one because it matches at all these endpoints. But internally, I have actually interchanged world lines, and then you can get caught up in knot theory and figuring out, well, is this going to be ergodic? Or are there configuration of these world lines that are propagating in imaginary time that will be not accessible by something like this? And then you have to be clever. I can tell you that no, you need to do a bit more than that. But hey, I just well, we have to stop somewhere. So there's lots of interesting development. Of course, what is happening today in these Monte Carlo methods is that people have gotten really, really good at doing this for a number of interesting quantum models. But there is today, in my opinion, a humongous problem with this that we always hope that somebody will solve. And that's the fact that when we look at these elements, then this here is actually less than zero, and that one is less than zero. So, oops, there's a little problem here, because you can see that what I do here when I exchange something like this with something like that, I'm actually going to be pulling out elements from this matrix here and use them as weight in my Monte Carlo algorithm. And this here is no good, because this here would be, it looks like a negative probability. And so that means that I have something that's called a sign problem. So when I run these Monte Carlo methods, then everything looks really, really great, and then suddenly you realize that under the stochastic sampling there will be configurations that will have a negative probability. And that's very hard to circumvent. There's a way of doing it, but that turns out to fail rather miserably. So I don't think there's any real understanding today of why these, or what is the, from a perhaps a computational computer science perspective or complexity issue, what is the relation between the sign problem as it occurs and then the underlying physics of the model? Is there some kind of a connection? There's some attempts where people say that the occurrence of this sign problem, and it hooks into, solving it or circumventing it would be tantamount to providing solutions to what are called NP-complete problems. And from that perspective, if you believe that we cannot solve NP-complete problems, then this could never be solved. But that connection is not very clear, and whether that holds true or not, I don't think anybody knows today. So sign problems occur, and just if you want to think about it, it would just mean that when you're flipping your little easing spin in your current algorithm, then you're calculating an e to the minus delta e, and that would be now coming out of a matrix here. And for the quantum problems, it can just be that this e to the minus delta e, it turns out to be negative. And then, well, suddenly the idea of doing a random walk on a lattice, hey, can't do that anymore, right? Because so the beautiful trick of substituting in this other dynamical process that solved everything for us, it doesn't work anymore. Thank you all for listening to this course. It's precisely 12:30, and I have done 3 weeks here, so it's been a pleasure to be here, and I hope you all profit from the rest of your stay here at Perimeter. Okay.
Yes, I would like to give you this T-shirt. This year it is a different color, and hopefully it should serve as an invitation for the next year for you to come and do the same course. Because the next year, the shirt will be different. Yeah, thank you.
My hope is that you can see that there are interesting things that can be done with these computational methods, and today people are pushing